In the first bulletin issued by the Lowell Observatory, in 1903, Professor Lowell describes a body that was seen on the Terminator of Mars, May 20, 1903. On May 27, it was suspected. If still there, it had moved, we are told, about 300 miles, probably a dust cloud. Very conspicuous and brilliant spots seen on the disk of Mars, October and November, 1911. Popular Astronomy, Volume 19, No. 10. So one of them accepted 6 or 7 observations that were in agreement, except that they could not be regularized, upon a world-planet satellite, and he gave it a name. He named it Neith. Monstrator and Elvira and Azuria and Super Romanimus. Or Heresy and Orthodoxy and the Oneness of All Quasinus, and our ways and means and methods are the very same. Or, if we name things that may not be, we are not of lonely guilt in the nomenclature of absences. But now Leverrier and Vulcan. Leverrier again. Or to demonstrate the collapsibility of a froth, stick a pin in the largest bubble of it. Astronomy and inflation, and by inflation we mean expansion of the attenuated. Or that the science of astronomy is a phantom film distended with myth stuff, but always our acceptance that it approximates higher to substantiality than did the system that preceded it. So Leverrier and the planet Vulcan. And we repeat, and it will do us small good to repeat. If you be of the masses that the astronomers have hypnotized being themselves hypnotized, or they could not hypnotize others, or that the hypnotist's control is not the masterful power that it is popularly supposed to be, but only transference of state from one hypnotic to another. If you be of the masses that the astronomers have hypnotized, you will not be able even to remember. 10 pages from here, and Leverrier and the planet Vulcan will have fallen from your mind, like beans from a magnet, or like data of cold meteorites from the mind of a Thomson. Leverrier and the planet Vulcan. And much the good it will do us to repeat. But at least temporarily we shall have an impression of a historic fiasco, such as, in our acceptance, could occur only in a quasi-existence. In 1859, Dr. Lescarbault, an amateur astronomer, of Orgeries, France, announced that, upon March 26, of that year, he had seen a body of planetary size cross the Sun. We are in a subject that is now as unholy to the present system as ever were its own subjects to the system that preceded it, or as ever were slanders against miracles to the preceding system. Nevertheless, few textbooks go so far as quite to disregard this tragedy. The method of the systematists is slightingly to give a few instances of the unholy, and dispose of the few. If it were desirable to them to deny that there are mountains upon this earth, they would record a few observations upon some slight eminences near Orange, NJ, but say that commuters, though estimable persons in several ways, are likely to have their observations mixed. The textbooks casually mention a few of the supposed observations upon Vulcan, and then pass on. Dr. Lescarbault wrote to Leverrier, who hastened to Orgeries. Because this announcement assimilated with his own calculations upon a planet between Mercury and the Sun. Because this solar system itself has never attained positiveness in the aspect of regularity, there are to Mercury, as there are to Neptune, phenomena irreconcilable with the formulas, or motions that betray influence by something else. We are told that Leverrier satisfied himself as to the substantial accuracy of the reported observation. The story of this investigation is told in monthly notices, 20-98. It seems too bad to threaten the naive little thing with our rude sophistications, but it is amusingly of the ingenuousness of the age from which present dogmas have survived. Lescarbault wrote to Leverrier. Leverrier hastened to. But he was careful not to tell Lescarbault who he was. Went right in and subjected Dr. Lescarbault to a very severe cross-examination, just the way you or I may feel at liberty to go into anybody's home and be severe with people pressing him hard step by step, just as anyone might go into someone else's house and press him hard, though unknown to the hard-pressed one. Not until he was satisfied, did Leverrier reveal his identity. I suppose Dr. Lescarbault expressed astonishment. I think there's something utopian about this, it's so unlike the standoffishness of New York life. Le Verrier gave the name Vulcan to the object that Dr. Lescarbault had reported. By the same means by which he is, even to this day, supposed by the faithful to have discovered Neptune, he had already announced the probable existence of an intramercurial body, or group of bodies. He had 5 observations besides Lescarbault's upon something that had been seen to cross the sun. In accordance with the mathematical hypnosis of his era, he studied these 6 transits. Out of them he computed elements giving Vulcan a period of about 20 days, or a formula for heliocentric longitude at any time. But he placed the time of best observation away up in 1877. But even so, or considering that he still had probably a good many years to live, it may strike one that he was a little rash, that is, if one has not gone very deep into the study of hypnosis, that, having discovered Neptune by a method which, in our acceptance, had no more to recommend it than had once equally well thought of methods of which finding, he should not have taken such chances, that if he was right as to Neptune, but should be wrong as to Vulcan, his average would be away below that of most fortune tellers, who could scarcely hope to do business upon a 50% basis, all that the reasoning of a tyro in hypnosis. The date: March 22, 1877. The scientific world was up on its hind legs nosing the sky. The thing had been done so authoritatively. Never a pope had said a thing with more of the seeming of finality. If 6 observations correlated, what more could be asked? The editor of Nature, a week before the predicted event, though cautious, said that it is difficult to explain how 6 observers, unknown to one another, could have data that could be formulated, if they were not related phenomena. In a way, at this point occurs the crisis of our whole book. Formulas are against us. But can astronomic formulas, backed up by observations in agreement, taken many years apart, calculated by a Le Verrier, be as meaningless, in a positive sense, as all other quasi things that we have encountered so far? The preparations they made, before March 22, 1877. In England, the Astronomer Royal made it the expectation of his life, notified observers at Madras, Melbourne, Sydney, and New Zealand, and arranged with observers in Chile and the United States. M. Struve had prepared for observations in Siberia and Japan. March 22, 1877. Not absolutely, hypocritically, I think it's pathetic, myself. If anyone should doubt the sincerity of Le Verrier, in this matter, we note, whether it has meaning or not, that a few months later he died. I think we'll take up Monstrator, though there's so much to this subject that we'll have to come back. According to the Annual Register, 9-120, upon the 9th of August, 1762, M. Duristan, of Basley, France, was taking altitudes of the sun, at Lausanne. He saw a vast, spindle-shaped body, about 3 of the sun's digits in breadth and 9 in length, advancing slowly across the disk of the sun, or at no more than half the velocity with which the ordinary solar spots move. It did not disappear until the 7th of September, when it reached the sun's limb. Because of the spindle-like form, I incline to think of a super zeppelin, but another observation, which seems to indicate that it was a world, is that, though it was opaque, and eclipsed the sun, it had around it a kind of nebulosity or atmosphere. A penumbra would ordinarily be a datum of a sunspot, but there are observations that indicate that this object was at a considerable distance from the sun. It is recorded that another observer, at Paris, watching the sun, at this time, had not seen this object. But that M. Croest, at Seoul, about 45 German leagues northward from Lausanne, had seen it, describing the same spindle form, but disagreeing a little as to breadth. Then comes the important point, that he and M. Duristan did not see it upon the same part of the sun. This, then, is parallax, and, compounded with invisibility at Paris, is great parallax, or that, in the course of a month, in the summer of 1762, a large, opaque, spindle-shaped body traversed the disk of the sun, but at a great distance from the sun. The writer in the register says, in a word, we know of nothing to have recourse to, in the heavens, by which to explain this phenomenon. I suppose he was not a hopeless addict to explaining. Extraordinary, we fear he must have been a man of loose habits in some other respects. As to us. Monstrator. In the monthly notices of the RAS, February, 1877, Leverrier, who never lost faith, up to the last day, gives the 6 observations upon an unknown body of planetary size, that he had formulated. Fritsch, October 10, 1802, Stark, October 9, 1819, De Kuyper, October 30, 1839, Sidebotham, November 12, 1849, Lascarbault, March 26, 1859, Lummis, March 20, 1862. If we weren't so accustomed to science in its essential aspect of disregard, we'd be mystified and impressed, like the editor of Nature, with the formulation of these data. Agreement of so many instances would seem incredible as a coincidence, but our acceptance is that, with just enough disregard, astronomers and fortune-tellers can formulate anything, or we'd engage, ourselves, to formulate periodicities in the crowds in Broadway. Say that every Wednesday morning, a tall man, with one leg and a black eye, carrying a rubber plant, passes the Singer Building, at 10:15. Of course it couldn't really be done, unless such a man did have such periodicity, but if some Wednesday mornings it should be a small child lugging a barrel, or a fat negress with a week's wash, by ordinary disregard that would be prediction good enough for the kind of quasi-existence we're in.